The Federal Reserve wrapped up a meeting today. Here's the readout.
You know, we're not thinking about raising rates. We're not even thinking about raising rates.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Wednesday, the 10th of June. Good to have you along. No surprises out of Chair Powell and the Federal Open Market Committee today.
There are just a lot of people that are unemployed, and it seems quite likely that there'll be a significant group at the end of even after a lot of strong job growth that'll still be struggling to find jobs, and we'll still be providing strong accommodation for that.
They wrapped up their regular two-day meeting, and the takeaway really was this.
It's not the risk for the next few months, but it's the risk over time of lasting damage to the productive capacity of the United States.
Lasting damage is kind of a regular refrain from the Fed chair, as is this.
It's possible that we will need to do more, and it's possible that Congress will need to do more.
Still kind of up in the air what Congress decides to do, though the conversation on Capitol Hill has moved away from whether it has to do another rescue package to when. Now, a quick macroeconomic indicator here before we go on. Inflation is something called the Consumer Price Index, which came out today. It's one of the measures of inflation. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about deflation versus disinflation. Deflation is falling prices over time. Disinflation is a slowdown in how quickly prices are going up. And that is what we've got, disinflation. Third month in a row, and we learned this morning that inflation at the consumer level has slowed. In May, on a year-over-year basis, inflation's running at just a 0.1%. On Wall Street today, a little deflation, a little inflation, depending on your favorite equity index. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A supermajority of the Minneapolis City Council has, as you've probably heard, said it's going to dismantle that city's police department, the most high-profile response to the defund the police movement. In California, the city of Sunnyvale in the San Francisco Bay Area has had a Department of Public Safety instead of a police department since 1950. Kai spoke to Chief Fan No of the Sunnyvale Department of Public Safety on the phone.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So you are, as I said in the introduction, the chief of public safety in the city of Sunnyvale. What's the difference between that and a police chief?
Well, the difference is that with what the Sunnyvale Department of Public Safety, we provide three services to our residents. It's fire, police, and EMS services. So I'll give you a perfect example. When I first came here from the San Jose Police Department, which is a traditional police department. I think it was just maybe my first month here. I went to a call of a house fire, and you know, obviously my fire personnel were out there. But in addition to that, there were patrol officers driving marked patrol vehicles that had changed into fire turnouts, and they were helping to put out the fire also. So after the fire was put out, one of my patrol officers came back to me and said, "Hey, Chief, I'm done here. I'm going to put back my police uniform and go back to answering police calls for service." And so that's a great example of how we do business here in Sunnyvale.
The crux of the matter right now, Chief, in a lot of cities, is accountability for specifically police officers and police actions. Do you believe that your paradigm favorably influences that? Does it make a difference in how you hold your officers accountable?
You know, I'm a little bit biased because I'm a firm believer in this program, but I certainly believe that it has something to do with it because of the fire discipline and the EMS discipline. Because firefighters are often seen by community members as caretakers. People will help you out. So I do think, to a certain extent, it does have a positive impact in what we do here in our city.
How closely are you watching, and I imagine the answer is very closely, the defund police movement and the movement in Washington for some kind of national police reform?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to start out by saying, you know, what happened to George Floyd should never have happened. I think all of us are condemning what happened. It was just a terrible tragedy for our country. And we have heard a lot from our community members, and certainly Sunnyvale, even though we enjoy great support from community, we're not immune. But in terms of you talking about defunding, meaning divesting resources to other services like mental health, I am open, you know, to listening to what people have to say. I'm open to the idea of sharing resources, you know, changing some of the things that we're currently doing in law enforcement. But when you talk about completely defunding or abolishing law enforcement, I don't believe that is a practical idea, although I would be more than happy to sit down and hear what people have to say and what that would look like if police departments across the country are completely abolished.
Last question, Chief, and then I'll get out of your hair. This model that you have, with some degree of success in Sunnyvale, do you think it scales? I mean, Sunnyvale is not a huge city. Could it work in Los Angeles or New York?
Look, I'm a big fan of this model, and I wish that this model could be implemented everywhere. However, I understand there are unique circumstances, capacity, you know, resources that you would have to consider if you want to have this model. And I would leave it to the cities to determine whether this is something that they would want to have in their respective city. And if they want to ask me questions on how it can happen, I would be more than happy to assist. But I'm a firm advocate for this public safety model.
Fonno is the chief of the Department of Public Safety in Sunnyvale, California, up in the San Francisco Bay Area. Chief, thanks very much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
You may have heard my story yesterday, taking us back to the history of accounting in this economy and how it was used on slaveholding plantations in the South. Today, slightly more recent history, an example of how black people were, and sometimes are, excluded from some jobs. This story starts at a park in Compton, just south of downtown L.A. It's got some grassy fields, a couple of baseball diamonds, no plaque, though, commemorating its part in Hollywood history. But maybe there ought to be. KCRW's David Weinberg picks it up from here.
At first, the men who gathered in Athens Park met after getting off work at their day jobs.
We would meet out there at the park in the evening and get dog. We'd be doing jumping jacks, and we, with the help of a few people, learning how to throw punches.
That's Alex Brown. It wasn't long before people in the neighborhood started to wonder exactly what kind of fight he and his friends were training for.
At that time, you know, there was a lot of racial tension at that time. We actually had the police come by and set up outside of our area and chain them. We would begin to, you know, watch us.
But what the police were watching was a group of men training to become Hollywood stuntmen. Back in the early 60s, there was no such thing as a black stuntman in Hollywood. The practice then was to do what was called a paint down. A white stuntman painted his body black to double a black actor. All that changed in 1965 with the TV show I Spy. One of the lead actors was Bill Cosby, and he refused to let a white stuntman play his double. And that's how Calvin Brown became the first black stuntman in Hollywood. But it was still hard for black stuntmen to get training and break into the business. So the men who met in Athens Park formed their own group called the BSA, Black Stuntmen's Association.
Well, that's all we ever wanted was jobs, just to get an equal piece of the pie, a little sliver. So as we began to make inroads to the motion picture business, the other white stunt group was getting a little insulted at the fact we had begun to infringe onto their financial base.
Being a stuntman was very lucrative compared to what BSA members made at their day jobs. William J. Upton was the youngest BSA member. He was just 12 years old when he showed up at Athens Park.
My mother and father were working. They were making like $60, $65 a piece a week back in 1967.
And the salary for a stuntman?
Back then in 1967, a contract was $120 a day. And my mother said, what? $120 a day back in 1967? He said, boy, go over there and join that group.
Over the years, the BSA filed dozens of lawsuits in its fight for equality in the film industry. including a 1976 case that forced the major studios to abide by federal mandates against discriminatory hiring. And as the BSA grew, it broadened its mission to include gender equity for stunt performers. Today, the push is to bring women and people of color into the role of stunt coordinators because they are the ones with the hiring power.
Right now, we probably have a 0.5% of women who are coordinating.
In 1998, BSA member LaFay Baker became the first African-American woman stunt coordinator of a big budget project, the TV movie Introducing Dorothy Dandridge, starring Halle Berry. She has since worked on projects where stunt coordinators didn't hire any women or people of color.
If I'm a stunt coordinator, I'm thinking about bringing a diverse group of people.
Today, most everyone in the BSA is retired. The work they used to do has been taken on by SAG-AFTRA, the union that represents stunt performers. As late as 2014, SAG-AFTRA investigated a paint down that happened at Warner Brothers. The studio acknowledged the paint down and said, quote, "The situation has been rectified and we regret the error." SAG-AFTRA is also investigating the practice of wigging. That's when a male stunt performer dresses as a woman to double female actors.
It never ends, you know, so the more we fight it, the better it'll be for other people. The ones that's coming behind us in this generation behind us, they got to keep going too.
Brown and the surviving members of the BSA are working behind the scenes to get some recognition for the doors they opened. Their next big goal is to raise the $50,000 they need to get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. In Los Angeles, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up.
But it still doesn't answer the question of where exactly is the money going to come from?
Often the unanswered question, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 282 points, 1%, to finish at 26,989. The NASDAQ is up 66 points, 0.6%, to close at 10,020. And the S&P 500 lost 17 points, 0.5%, to land at 3,190. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. File this one under things are going to look different when this pandemic's run its course. Starbucks said today it's going to close as many as 400 stores over the next year and a half and renovate and relocate others. More on-the-go options, too, like drive-through, walk-up windows, and curbside pickup. From Austin, Texas, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on the changes coming to your morning latte.
Starbucks has been pushing the mobile order and pickup for a while, but more customers are doing it because of COVID-19, like me this morning.
I'm good. Hey, I ordered on the app.
Andy.
Thank you so much.
You too. Take care.
I was in and out with my cold brew and iced lemon loaf cake in under a minute. Didn't feel like the not your work, not your home destination that Starbucks used to be going for, what they called the third place.
In the short term, there's probably a reimagination of what the third place looks like.
Trevor Boomstra is a restaurant industry consultant with Alex Partners. He says Starbucks plans to open more to-go-only locations and add additional drive-through lanes at existing stores. There's a sense of urgency because Starbucks said it lost more than $3 billion in revenue since the onset of the pandemic. Alex Suskin teaches food and beverage management at Cornell.
Starbucks wants to get people back into the daily routine of having Starbucks. Emphasizing the to-go element will make it easier for them to reach everybody consistently.
Giant companies like Starbucks can afford to invest in rethinking and reshaping business models. But Spencer Torr at Coffee Enterprises says others don't have that luxury.
A lot of independent specialty cafes may not have the facilities to be able to do that kind of service to maintain the financial integrity of their business.
He says other retailers will be looking to Starbucks to see what works, as all restaurants make post-COVID-19 adjustments. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here's another thing that's going to look different, well before this pandemic has run its course. Performing arts. We talked about Broadway a couple weeks ago. The Metropolitan Opera in New York City has announced it's canceling its fall season. Today, the New York Philharmonic followed suit. A couple of the big players in the arts world bowing to reality. Marketplace's Christian Schwab looked into the ways that slice of this economy is trying to stay afloat.
Every night at 7:30 Eastern, the Metropolitan Opera streams a recorded performance. Today, it's Hansel and Gretel, the fairy tale about a brother and sister lost in the woods. Okay, watching this from your couch in sweatpants doesn't scream glamorous evening at the opera. But for dance, music, and theater, this is unfortunately the way things might have to be for a while.
Yeah, I don't think there's any substitute to the live, in-person, non-virtual events.
Sunil Iyengar is the research director at the National Endowment for the Arts. He says performing arts nonprofits get about 40% of their revenue from ticket sales, concessions, and gift shops. And streaming free performances online and asking for donations won't make up for that. Companies already rely on donors for almost half their budgets.
I think a lot of organizations are struggling with this issue of how do you monetize these strategies.
Pamela Robinson, a professor of performing arts administration at New York University, says this isn't just about making money now, but about attracting new audiences in the future.
You know, it's really important to stay in touch with your patrons. And even after you open, that could open the doors to additional revenue and recognition.
Robinson says one canceled fall could impact companies for the next 2 years. That means there may not be money for new productions or splashy sets. Companies might have to rely on their old standards. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The conversations we're having right now in this country about race and racism in the wake of the killing of George Floyd are, first of all, overdue, and also hard, depending on who you are. But we're having them, a lot of them, and Hollywood has noticed. A couple of big documentary projects about civil rights in America have been greenlighted and are getting funded. Marketplace's Jasmine Gartz reports.
Documentary films have always had a hard time getting funded. They just don't easily translate into box office hits. Professor Mia Mask with Vassar College says when it comes to investment,
filmmakers of color have an even more difficult time. Certainly there are outliers, Spike Lee and obviously Ava DuVernay's 13th and her wonderful work. But there are many filmmakers of color, Black and Latino in particular, who really struggle.
Hollywood has been vocally supportive of the ongoing protests demanding racial justice. There's been a lot of talk about the need for more diverse writers' rooms, but artists and activists say Tinseltown needs to put its money where its mouth is, fund more diverse projects. Rashid Shabazz with the nonprofit Color of Change says it's time to look into
the question of resources and power, the decision about what gets greenlit and what doesn't, what gets more marketing budget and what doesn't. And often those things are cut against racial lines, and often it's a very black and white issue.
Funding is happening, just not entirely through Hollywood money. NBA stars LeBron James and Russell Westbrook have taken matters into their own hands and are producing various films about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, in which hundreds of African Americans were killed and injured by white residents in Oklahoma. Professor Jason E. Squire from the University of Southern California says there is an audience.
You know, documentaries back in the day had a reputation of, oh, it's going to be very preachy and teachy, and I don't know if I'm going to go see it. And that's changed. A public appetite for documentaries has just increased exponentially.
If it gets made, people will watch, now more than ever. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
When something like this pandemic happens, a global crisis, it has a tendency to change priorities. People's priorities change, companies' priorities change, entire parts of the economy change. Scientists, here and globally, have turned their attention to the coronavirus, the disease it brings, and a search for a vaccine, often at the expense of other research. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes a look at what it will take to get all that science going again.
On March 17th, Isabella Rauch got bad news. She's an immunologist at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland who studies how pathogens get into the body through the intestines. And she had just a few days to shut down her lab. That meant somebody had to euthanize over 100 mice. And Rauch had to decide which tissue cultures to toss and which might have some value in future research.
I basically had to try and guess
what is going to be the most important thing for my lab over the next couple of years.
The mice they kept alive are being stored and cared for by lab staff. The tissue samples they kept are
stored at minus 150 degrees in liquid nitrogen.
That introduced yet another complication during lockdown.
We were really worried that the supply chain for this would break down because it evaporates relatively fast.
And all that happened in just 3 days. Across the country, thousands of labs and research projects were abruptly shut down as the country went into lockdown. So did clinical trials on people. Kevin Sheth is a neurologist at Yale. With social distancing, more than a dozen of his clinical trials into traumatic brain disorders were paused or shut down.
If you have longer trial timelines, it means that the cost of the trials become increased. The whole marketing outlook changes. I mean, there are huge financial costs.
And even with labs reopening, there are increased costs. One of Sheth's trials has to restart at 120 research sites across the country.
And right now, every center is developing their own research process for how they come online and what the local rules are.
Local rules about social distancing. Those are going to change the way science is done in laboratories, too. John Roll is dean of research at Washington State University's medical school. He's been locked out of his labs for nearly 100 days.
That poses some trouble if you're running an active research protocol.
Roll says as some of his labs start getting ready to reopen with social distancing protocols in place, he's worried that doing science there will feel different than it used to.
An active research university is such a vibrant place to be. And every day there's conversations happening. People are thinking of new ways to do this. And I find it's hard to replicate those on Zoom if a lot of that happens in the hall when you're talking to your colleagues or friends.
At Oregon Health and Science University, Isabella Rauch is slowly getting her lab back up and running. Researchers will work staggered hours. She'll supervise students via video. They'll have to figure out how to sanitize a $100,000 microscope every time someone is done using it. Samples will be thawed out and mice will have to be rebred. That'll take months. Then there's the matter of money. The lab needs to start applying for grants right away. And to do that, there has to be some sort of preliminary data to show.
We might have to make different priorities that we would usually make. So maybe prioritize experiments that are easier to do or in a shorter time frame or where we don't need as much preparation time or we don't need as much microscopy time.
It's unclear how federal funding agencies will deal with delayed research, according to Kevin Sheth at Yale.
The message from the NIH and the FDA has been that they recognize, you know, what's happening. They have reaffirmed the importance of doing research like this and I think are going to do everything they can to continue to support these trials. But it still doesn't answer the question of where exactly is the money going to come from?
A coalition of research universities has asked Congress for $26 billion to get research going again. And that's only if there isn't a second wave of COVID-19 that shuts the labs down again. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the words of the president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, the director of the National Economic Council, asked today whether he thought the black unemployment rate staying basically unchanged last month is evidence of systemic racism in this economy. We're going to play it long so you can hear the whole answer.
No, I do not. And I don't believe there's systemic racism in the U.S. I'm not going to go into a long riff on it. Black employment increased 300,000. Did you know that? You did?
Yeah.
Right. So that's a big win. And the black employment to population ratio went up over a percentage point. That's a big win. And we do believe that returning to growth and prosperity creates opportunities for everybody.
A couple of minutes later, he was asked basically the same question again.
I will say it again. I do not. I think the harm comes when you have some very bad apples on the law enforcement side. What was done to Mr. Floyd was abysmal. But I believe everyone in this country agrees with that.
We've got to go. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kimberly Adams, and we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.